And we're reading from Romans chapter 3, starting from verse 1. Then what advantage has the Jew? Or what is the value of circumcision? Much, in every way. To begin with, the Jews were entrusted with the oracles of God. What if some were unfaithful? Does their faithlessness nullify the faithfulness of God? By no means. Let God be true, though everyone were a liar, as it is written, that you may be justified in your words and prevail when you are judged. But if our unrighteousness serves to show the righteousness of God, what shall we say? That God is unrighteous to inflict wrath on us? I speak in a human way. By no means. For then how could God judge the world? But if through my lie God's truth abounds to his glory, why am I still being condemned as a sinner? And why not do evil that good may come, as some people slanderously charge us with, saying, slanderously charge us with saying, their condemnation is just. What then? Are we Jews any better off? No, not at all. For we have already charged that all, both Jews and Greeks, are under sin. As it is written, none is righteous, no, not one. No one understands, no one seeks for God. All have turned aside, together they have become worthless. No one does good, not even one. Their throat is an open grave. They use their tongues to deceive. The venom of asps is under their lips. Their mouth is full of curses and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. In their paths are ruin and misery, and the way of peace they have not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes. Now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be stopped and the whole world may be held accountable to God. For by works of the law, no human being will be justified in his sight, since through the law comes knowledge of sin.
This afternoon we're in court. Not only are we in court, we are in court for the judge's verdict. God is at the judge's bench and we are in the dock. And we've reached that point in the trial where the whole outcome has essentially become cut and dried. Every escape avenue for the defendant has been stopped. And the bleak verdict of an impartial and holy judge is about to be pronounced over our lives. There are no loopholes. We are guilty. And we face condemnation. Some of you will remember Jonathan Aitken, the disgraced former cabinet minister who found himself sent down for perjury. After he completed his prison sentence, I interviewed him here at St. Helens. The place was rammed, standing room only. It was a gripping occasion. Perhaps most riveting was when he described what it's like as one is sent down from the dock in the Old Bailey with the guilty verdict and the prison sentence ringing in the ears. There is apparently a communal cell with iron bars. And as he found himself there following his trial, there were all the other criminals alongside him. One man sitting, weeping uncontrollably. Another, tattoos all the way up and down his arms and legs, clinging onto the bars and banging his head against them. And Jonathan said this, every criminal he ever met genuinely thought that they would get off until they found themselves in the cage. Before summing up the verdict, in verse 9, Paul turns one last time to the Jew, seeking to appeal to what we might call favored nation status, verses 1 to 8. And here he argues that all face judgment. There is no immunity. And what Paul does is to hold out four key pillars of God's revealed character, behind which the faithfully religious might seek shelter. We have to picture the apostle in the synagogue arguing with a Jewish religious audience. The religious always want to plead special protection. Surely immunity is available for us. And their case goes something like this. If there is no immunity for the Jew, well, surely that raises questions about God's own character, and thus, therefore, surely there must be immunity for the Jew. The four pillars of God's character that Paul holds up are first, God's commitment to the Jews, secondly, God's faithfulness to his promises, third, God's justice in judging, and fourth, truth. Let's just take numbers 2 and 3. We haven't got time to go through all of them. I'll read from verse 1. Then what advantage has the Jew, or what is the value of circumcision? Well, much in every way. To begin with, the Jews were entrusted with the oracles of God. In other words, you knew God. What if some were unfaithful? Does their faithlessness nullify the faithfulness of God? By no means. Let God be true, though everyone were a liar, as it's written, that you may be justified in your words and prevail when you are judged. Now, the argument is something like this. What if some Jews were unfaithful? Does the faithfulness of some Jews nullify the faithfulness of God to his promises to the Jews? And the point is that God made promises to the Jews in the Old Testament that they would be his people. So if some of his people fail, does this mean that the whole project to the Jews has failed? I was in the bank yesterday paying in some money, which is always a happy thing to be doing. Next to me, there was somebody drawing out money in £50 notes in cash. I have never seen so many £50 notes in my life before. I know it's rude to stare, particularly at a moment like that, but I noticed the person before me had glanced out of the corner of his eye, and I did exactly the same. I've never seen it. He must have been a banker, I suppose. But imagine if it turns out amongst those 200 or 350 pound notes that were being counted out again and again that 10 of them actually weren't worth the paper they were printed on. Does that then call the whole project? Does it mean the Bank of England's not going to pay out on the others? And that's the kind of argument. But here, the response is in verse 4, by no means. And what Paul is saying here is you fundamentally understood this. He quotes from Psalm 51, in which the great king of Israel, David, acknowledges that God is right to judge David's sin when David failed. And David was the most kosher of all Jews. And he acknowledged that it was right for God to judge him. It's never been the case that being Jewish gets a guilty Jewish person off the hook. If David couldn't get off the hook, God's promises for the Jews were never a blank check. No immunity there. So then in verse 5, the next religious detractor, remember we're in hot debate here in the synagogue, the next religious detractor raises the issue of God's justice, verse 5. But if our unrighteousness serves to show the righteousness of God, what shall we say, that God is unrighteous to inflict wrath on us? So Paul, if our unrighteousness, for which you're saying we're going to be judged, serves to show the righteousness of God in judging us, what shall we say? That God, because he benefits from our unrighteousness by being shown to be a righteous judge, is unrighteous to inflict judgment on us. Now, it is really perverse, isn't it? If our failure to behave rightly means that God has to judge us and therefore gets credit for showing himself to be judged through our failure to behave rightly, well, then is God somehow sullied by judging us, the Jews? God is gaining from our sin. Well, Paul's answer is great, isn't it? By no means. It's kind of, don't be so stupid, if I may put it like that. How could God judge anybody on that basis? You Jew, you know God's got to judge, and he's certainly going to judge the nations. And how could God judge the nations on that basis? Don't be so ridiculous. The arguments are contrary and the logic is perverse, but any of us who has had this kind of discussion in the pub after work will know just how much people wriggle to try and get off the hook. And in each case, what Paul does is simply to drive the nail deeper into the coffin. For what he is telling us is that the very pillars of Jewish identity, the character of God, his kindness to them, his faithfulness, his justice, his truth, these pillars each demand within themselves that God must judge fairly, Jew or not. And therefore, far from providing immunity, these great and grand character traits of God drive God to judge all the more. Now, a lot of people get themselves in a real tangle over these verses and lose the plot in the detail. One commentator says, quote, "This is one of the most difficult passages in the whole letter, so it's no surprise." But Romans chapter 3, verses 1 to 8 is not merely an argument about God's righteous character. And if you've heard that, then you've been led down a slight cul-de-sac. What Paul is doing is showing how God's righteous character means there's no let-up for the religious. This then is further condemnation for the religious person who thinks they're going to get off the hook because of various technicalities to do with God's character. The last one is in verses 7 and 8. We just look at that. But if through my lie God's truth abounds, in other words, I fail through my lie, and therefore God shows to be all the more true to his glory, why am I still being condemned as a sinner? Because actually, my lie is benefiting God. Why not do evil that good may come, as some people slanderingly charge us with saying? And Paul just finishes, their condemnation is just. In other words, if you want to be so perverse in the pub after work, trying to wriggle to get off the hook, I'm afraid you're just going to get what you deserve. There is no immunity. Remember the case of Harry Dunn and Anne Sokolos, wife of the US diplomat who fled after a car collided with his motorbike. There's no diplomatic immunity in God's court. Remember how he protested? Yeah, quite rightly. There will be no such diplomatic immunity in the court of God for the religious. All face judgment. There is no immunity. Well, Paul now moves in for the kill, verse 9 through 18. All are under sin. There is no exception. And verses 9 through 18 take a series of Old Testament passages, many of which are addressed in the first instance to non-Jews or to those in Israel who had rejected God. And in each case, Paul now uses them against both Jew and Gentile alike. Let's notice the universality of it in verses 9 through 12. And let's notice the specificity of it in verses 13 through 18. All are under sin. What then, are we Jews any better off? No, not at all. For we've already charged that all, both Jew and Greeks, are under sin. None is righteous, no, not one. No one understands, no one seeks for God. All have turned aside, together they become worthless. No one does good, not even one. None? No, not one. No one. No one, all, together, not even one. The issue has to do with sin, and the issue to do with sin has to do with a failure to recognize God as God. Before sin has to do with the naughty actions we have done, sin has to do with the failure in attitude that we have shown. Before sin has to do with the naughty actions we have done, sin fundamentally has to do with the failure in attitude that we have shown. Remember, the first four of the Ten Commandments are vertically related. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your mind, all your soul, all your strength. And no one has done that. No one is right, none is righteous, not even one. No one understands, no one seeks for God. To seek is to inquire, to search after, to make diligent investigation. I sat next to a banker at our guest event last night. Why is God so obscure? He asked. Because you are hiding, I replied. And every part of our conversation subsequently proved my point. And God will not be found by those who are on the run. No one seeks God. All have turned aside. To turn aside is to deviate, deliberately to divert from. To become worthless is to render unfit for purpose, incapable of serving the end for which it is meant. So none is righteous, no, not one. No one understands, no one seeks for God. All have turned aside. Together they've become worthless. No one does good, not even one. And Paul's point is not that we never do anything that is good, nor that you and I never have a moment of decency, nor that there is nothing positive to say about any of us. No one can deny that there is so much that is good about humanity. And we saw a lot of that, didn't we, in the pandemic? But every aspect of every deed, because we do not recognize God as God or treat God as God, is tainted by that failure. So you walk around your office refusing to recognize the authority of your CEO, the governing board, and everything that your company stands for. Well, you may be a very good broker, but everything is tainted by your rebellion. You may do a great deal, but that deal is tainted by your rebellion. And that phrase at the start of the sentence is so strong, isn't it? We've already charged, verse 9, that all, both Jews and Greeks, are under sin. It's as if our wrong attitude towards God, our failure to recognize God as God, is like some all-powerful taskmaster that we cannot but obey. Don't you find that? However much you start the day out thinking, well, today's going to be different, by coffee time it isn't. And Paul's understanding is that all people were not just sinners, but actually helpless pawns under sin's power. I used to use the picture of a bowls ball. I have to say, I don't think I've ever really played bowls seriously, not in the white kit and all the rest of it. I think you'd be over 80 to do that. Sorry if you're a bowls player. But you know how it has that inbuilt bias? But I wonder slightly if the shopping trolley isn't a better illustration. You know, it goes off this way, you correct it, and then it goes off this way, and then you just can't keep it on the straight and narrow. And not even one at the end of the sentence of 12 is a remarkable claim. It is an impossible thing to find even a single human who has rightly sought to comprehend and grasp thoroughly and obey the living God. And so we're to picture the whole mass of humanity all together, none, no one, all together, not even one, across the globe and down through the ages. But we are also to picture each individual one by one, not even one. Every individual who's ever walked the face of this earth, standing before God on final judgment day. Is there a sinless one here? No. Is there a sinless one here? No. Is there sinlessness in this one? No. Did this one seek God fully from a pure heart? No. Can we find a right attitude to God in this one? No. I was picking up windfall apples in an orchard last week, even as I was preparing to speak on this, multitasking. and I was trying to find suitable apples for my mum to store into January in her cold store. They had to be perfect if they're going to last through to January, and they certainly had to be perfect for my mother. But there'd been a violent storm. There were no apples left on the trees. They were all on the ground. You'd pick up one. It looks like it's going to a blemish. You'd find another one. This looks perfect. A slug's got it. You got it, this one. Oh, no, that one's blemished. Not even one. But if verses 10 to 12 speak of the universality of it, 13 through 18 speak of specificity. All are under sin. There is no exception. It's universal and it's very specific. Action as well as attitude. You want evidence of the universal nature of sin? Well, verse 13 and 14, let's look at your speech. Verse 15 and 16, let's look at your deeds. Verse 18, let's do an MRI scan of your heart. Their throat is an open grave. They use their tongues to deceive. The venom of asps is under their lips. Their mouth is full of curses and bitterness. These verses have to do with our language, don't they? The open grave is ready to receive bodies. It makes those who come into contact with the dead already there impure and defiled. The open grave is a trap that unsuspecting fall into. Their throat is an open grave. They use their tongues to deceive. The tongue is used to tell the half-truth, to veil reality. The tongue is used only to present one side of the picture. The tongue is used to bring my story into the best light. The tongue is used only to have the client know a percentage of what they need to know. Their throat is an open grave. They use their tongues to deceive. The venom of asps is under their lips. That's very telling, isn't it? It's hidden. These deadly fangs, you don't see them, you just see the smile. But lurking below the lips, that infamous but. Oh, she's great at her job, but he's huge fun to be with, but the knife between the shoulder blades, the deadly arrow launched as the send button is pressed, the stiletto inserted. Their throat is an open grave. They use their tongues to deceive. The venom of asps is under their lips. Their mouth is full of curses and bitterness. I don't know if you've read the letter James wrote at the end of the New Testament. How great a forest is set ablaze by such a small fire. The tongue is set among our members, staining the whole body, setting on fire the entire course of life. Every kind of beast and bird and reptile and sea creature can be tamed and has been tamed by mankind, but no human can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil, full of deadly poison. So you want to know what wickedness the tongue can do? May I see your social media comments over the last 5 years? May I view your encrypted messages? Remember Neera Tanden, the Biden nominee for the Office of Budgetary Affairs. On her appointment, what did she do? Deleted thousands of tweets. May I have your Facebook history? Verses 15 through 17 move from language to action. Their throat is an open, verse 15, their feet are swift to shed blood, and in their paths are ruin and misery, and the way of peace they have not known. Remember Jesus, you've heard that it was said, you shall not commit murder, and everyone who murders is liable to judgment. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. I read that passage to someone the other day and said to them, have you ever had a murderous thought? To which he replied, have I ever driven in London? You doubt Paul's assessment in verses 15 through 17 of humanity, open your news feed. William and Harry, Colleen and Rebecca. Every one of us here, however well-intentioned, will be aware of broken relationships, damaged family no-go areas. Their feet are swift to shed blood, in their paths are ruin and misery, and the way of peace they have not known. And then finally, there is no fear of God before their eyes. With God ever present in all his creation, and with God's all-seeing eye knowing all that we do, do we fear him as much as public opinion about ourselves, our reputation in the office? So all will face judgment. There is no immunity. All are under sin. There is no exception. All stand condemned. There's no room for appeal. And verses 19 through 20 are very straightforward. Now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law. We've already established that whether you have the Ten Commandments or not, you still have law, regulation. We know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be stopped. The judge is basically saying, shut up, will you? Do you remember how Saddam Hussein, when he was in court, tried to protest his innocence at the end of it? The judge would have nothing. Remember how that guy from the Bosnian War sought to protest his innocence? The judge wouldn't have anything of it. And nor will God. Whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law, which is absolutely everybody, so that every mouth may be stopped and the whole world held accountable to God. By the law and works of the law, no human being will be justified. You haven't got a leg to stand on. Don't try appealing to your track record. Your track record is rubbish. Don't try appealing to your religion. Your religion doesn't cut it. Don't try wriggling out in that pub discussion by saying, oh, well, the character of God. No, the character of God demands that you be judged. Don't try saying, oh, well, I was just a decent person. I thoroughly disapproved of all those bad people. Yeah, but you did the same things. Don't try saying, well, I just didn't know there was a God. God made himself perfectly plain through his creation. And so there is no excuse and no escape. Jonathan Aitken, we began with, in that interview, said every criminal he has ever met thought they'd get off until they got into the cage. And what the Apostle Paul is doing is seeking, if you like, a guilty plea from us before we get into the cage. He wants us to see that we stand condemned, that there is only one solution, and that is in the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. So that rather than pleading not guilty, we plead for mercy. And we'll come to that in 3 weeks' time. I'm going to lead us in prayer. We pray, our Father in heaven, that in your kindness you would move through the city amongst our neighbours and friends, and in your goodness bring, well, a spirit of recognition of where we really stand, an end to silly protestations, an awareness of the living God, a deep sense of the reality of coming judgment, and a readiness to recognize the evidence that is heaped up against each one of us, so that we might come to you seeking mercy and not protesting our innocence. In Jesus' name, amen.